ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on Animal Concerns of Texas, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and also the best thing that one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, if you're concerned about your health, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we have a conversation with Nick Cooney, Director of Education at Mercy for Animals and author of the new book, How to Be Great at Doing Good. That's coming up a little later on the show, but first some news.
According to a report from the Center for Biological Diversity, more than 150,000 Americans signed a petition that was delivered urging the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the Secretary of Agriculture to adopt the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee's recommendation for less meat and more plant-based foods. The petition was delivered to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and to the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C. The petition, led by the Center for Biological Diversity and Friends of Earth, was supported by more than a dozen environmental, public health, and food advocacy organizations as part of a larger effort showing the widespread support among experts in the American public for science-based dietary guidelines that promote health and sustainability. The groups also signed on to a joint statement in favor of the recommendations for less meat and more plant-based foods that originally appeared in a full-page ad in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and now has gathered support from more than 150 organizations and experts. A spokesperson for the Center of Biological Diversity states that Americans in every corner of the country are moving toward diets that are better for themselves and better for wildlife and our planet, especially by eating less meat, and that in this era of climate change, drought, and diet-related health crises, the government should be leading us with dietary guidelines that are healthy and sustainable for us all. The guidelines are a government-approved blueprint for healthy diets and are widely used in nutrition education programs and to set the meal plans for government institutions, including schools, prisons, military facilities, and federal cafeterias. This year is the first time sustainable considerations were included in the scientific report used to inform the final guidelines. In addition to signing the petition, thousands of Americans have submitted comments to the agencies in support of including both health and sustainability in the 2015 dietary guidelines. The Department of Health and Human Services reported receiving an unprecedented number of comments this year, with more than 20,000 comments compared to only 1,200 comments during the 2010 dietary guidelines process. Let's hope they implement these guidelines right away.
Studies have shown that young people who torture and kill animals are prone to violence against people later in life if it goes unchecked. A new federal category for animal cruelty crimes will help root out these animal abusers before their behavior worsens. For years, the FBI has filed animal abuse under the label Other, along with a variety of lesser crimes, making cruelty to animals hard to keep track of. Recently, the FBI announced that it would make animal cruelty a Group A felony within its own category, the same way crimes like homicide, arson, and assault are listed. The FBI said in a statement that law enforcement agencies will have to report incidents and arrests in four areas: simple or gross neglect, intentional abuse and torture, organized abuse, such as dogfighting and cockfighting, and animal sexual abuse. John Thompson, interim executive director of the National Sheriff's Association, worked to get the new animal cruelty category instituted. Mr. Thompson said, "Officers will start to see the data as facts and not just somebody saying the Son of Sam killed animals before he went to human victims, and that 70% of school shooters abused animals prior to doing their acts before people." FBI studies show that serial killers like Jeffrey Dahmer tortured and killed dogs and cats as a child. David Berkowitz, known as the Son of Sam, poisoned his mother's parakeet, and Albert DeSalvo, also known as the Boston Strangler, killed dogs and cats. It will take time and money to update FBI and law enforcement databases nationwide to revise manuals and to send out guidelines, so data won't be collected until January 2016. After that, it will take several months before there are numbers to analyze. The new animal cruelty statistics will allow police and counselors to work with children who show early signs of trouble. The FBI's category will track crimes nationwide and is bound to give animal cruelty laws in all 50 states more clout. Many states are seeing more of those convicted of animal cruelty being sentenced to prison, in marked contrast to years past.
From the online newsletter, The Dodo, a great burden has been lifted for 60 elephants who will no longer be forced to give rides or perform tricks at a popular elephant camp in West Thailand. Instead, the camp will follow in the footsteps of Elephant Nature Park, ENP, a renowned rescue and rehabilitation center supported by visitors who want to help elephants. Elephant rides, such as those at the camp in West Thailand, may appear harmless, but brutality drives captive elephant training. Calves are often violently stolen from their families in the wild. To give rides, an elephant must first be broken or beaten into submission. ENP has a different idea of ecotourism. Its visitors' activities include feeding and bathing the elephants, who are given abundant open space on which to roam. The goal is that, under ENP's guidance, the camp will retire its 60 elephants from labor by July. So next time you're planning a vacation, skip the elephant rides and visit sanctuaries and rehabilitation centers instead.
Stay with us. Coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature a conversation with Nick Cooney. Nick is Director of Education at Mercy for Animals, a national nonprofit animal protection organization. He's also the author of three books, Change of Heart, What Psychology Can Teach Us About Spreading Social Change, Veganomics, The Surprising Science on What Motivates Vegetarians, and his newest book is How to Be Great at Doing Good, Why Results Are What Counts, and How Smart Charity Can Change the World. We'll be discussing charity with Nick Cooney next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, Nick Cooney. Hey, thanks for being with us, Nick.
Thank you for having me on.
Nick, can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in animal activism?
Sure. So I got involved in animal advocacy when I was 18, after first learning about some of the different ways that animals are used and abused on factory farms and other places. And over the next few years, while I was involved in other social justice issues, the animal issue came to take priority for me just from realizing how many animals were being abused, how bad that abuse was, and how much things could change in a positive direction if I and others just worked for that.
And so what were some of the things that you first came across that got you thinking about animals and really what happens and what goes on behind closed doors?
Well, for me, it started with a conversation with a friend that I met right as I started college. That got me to go to my local library and check out the two books that they had on animal protection issues.
Wow, this must have been years ago.
Yeah, this was back in 1999, so a very different world than today in terms of animals. But yeah, one of those books was the great classic Animal Liberation by the philosopher Peter Singer, which discussed the different ways that animals are used and abused, and for me it was completely eye-opening.
Yeah. So your new book, How to Be Great at Doing Good, it's about charity and altruism. And in reading it, I realized, you know, a lot of people have the motivation of personal rewards or satisfaction when they perform charitable acts. But it goes deeper than that. Can you explain a little bit about the motivation behind charity?
Sure. So for most of us, most Americans either donate to charity or they volunteer their time with a charity or both. And it's certainly great that we have those charitable impulses. But here's the problem. The problem is that most Americans who do donate or volunteer, we're making those decisions about where to donate and where to volunteer. based on things like what we might feel particularly passionate about, issues that are relevant to us. For example, maybe I had a son who had cancer, so I donate towards cancer charities. We donate or get involved with charities that happen to be based in our community. And the problem is, with the approach that we take to charity, is that we don't always focus on what the end result is and where to donate and where to volunteer if we want to get the best end result possible.
So, yeah, that sounds kind of counterintuitive because, like most people, as you said, they feel like, well, this is something I'm interested in. I'm going to invest my time in it. I'm very concerned about the environment, so I'm going to join environmental organization X because I saw a flyer from them. And so you're saying they make these decisions not based upon, like, a cost-benefit output of their time and money?
That's right. And let me give you a study that really makes clear how widespread that is. So there was a landmark study carried out in 2010 that surveyed over 15,000 donors to charity in the United States. And what it found is that only 3% of donors, only 3% of these 15,000 people surveyed were picking which charities to support and which causes to support based on how much good those causes or those charities did. The other 97% were picking charities based on other things. So that could be what they felt passionate about, what was relevant to them, or what was local to them. And the result of that is that we as a charitable people and we as individuals, we accomplish far less good than we could by taking that approach to charity.
Well, I think now that we're all interconnected with the World Wide Web, we have a little bit better access to the facts. When you talked about cancer a moment ago, and I've had people close to me die of cancer, so when I was called on the phone by the Cancer Fund of America, I was quick on the phone to say, sure, I'll donate. But then I looked them up online and found out they were one of the worst charities, that most of their money went to fundraising.
That's a very good example. And similarly, I have family members who have had cancer. And so in past years, I've done charity cancer walks and so forth. And certainly, it's very understandable that for the many of us who do have family or friends or relatives who have had cancer, that we feel the urge to donate towards cancer charities. And some of those charities do a very good job. But the broader question that we need to step back and ask ourselves, or at least that I think we should step back and ask ourselves, is what is the ultimate goal of charity? Is the goal of charity, is the goal of writing that donation check, is the goal to do the most good we can, you know, to reduce the most suffering, to help the greatest number of individuals, or is the goal to do something that's good, whether it's a lot of good or a little bit of good? And for most of us, the way that we're taught to think about charity is that as long as you're doing something good, as long as you're volunteering your time or giving a donation, you are doing a good thing. But right. What this book is about, what How to Be Great at Doing Good is about, is really taking things to the next level. Of not just doing something good, but asking ourselves, how can we do the most good? So what are the charities, what are the causes that we might want to support in order to help the greatest number of individuals possible?
Right. So I think that leads to the tough question, and it's how to figure out and by what methods do you determine which charities are doing the most good?
That is a tough question. And there hasn't been, up until the last couple of years, there has not been a lot of information out there or resources out there for donors to look to make those decisions. There are a few good websites now, so I know many of your listeners are concerned with animal issues. There's a great new website that's been out for just the past few years called www.animalcharityevaluators.org. That's animalcharityevaluators.org. And what they are an independent third-party charity monitoring agency and a donor advisory agency. So they research hundreds of animal protection charities, thoroughly vet a number of those with looking through their financial returns and interviews with staffers and so forth. And then they make recommendations for donors. So if you're a donor and you want your donation to help the greatest number of animals possible, they will suggest which charities you might want to donate to help the greatest number of animals.
But how do you determine how the greatest number of animals are helped? Because, I mean, if you just think of sheer numbers, aren't fish and poultry among the most exploited animals, at least for food production?
You're definitely right about that. Chickens and fish, especially farm-raised fish, which about half of the fish we consume are farm-raised at this point, live lives of incredible misery, confined in feces-filled pools where they can barely turn around, or for chickens confined in dirty warehouses where they can barely move. These are animals that live a lifetime in really deplorable, terrible conditions. And, you know, one of the things that this website I mentioned, this advisory organization I mentioned, Animal Charity Evaluators, found is that, indeed, if you want to donate to protect animals, while there's all sorts of animal causes, from wildlife to shelter and rescue to wild animals to sanctuaries and so forth, that the area where you can help the greatest number of individual animals and spare the most animal suffering happens to be farm animal advocacy.
That's true.
And it's specifically because there are so many animals being abused so badly, and it's actually not that difficult to protect at least a number of them from that cruelty and despair, a number of them from living a lifetime of misery. In fact, Animal Charity Evaluators research, and I can tell you that the research I have done with the animal protection charities I work with, suggests that it actually takes less than $1 for each animal that can be spared from a lifetime of misery when we're looking at the most effective farm animal advocacy charities.
When I was reading your book, I was remembering that my favorite charity has helped animals to a very small extent. The Buffalo Field Campaign works to save bison at Yellowstone, and I'm a National Park Service ranger. I don't know how much good they have done, but they are one of the top charities I give to. When we give to charities, there's also a strong emotional content, you know, a personal involvement in the issues.
You're right, and you know, that example that you're giving from your own life is a very great classic example that I think is the case for most people who donate to charity. That's certainly where I think all of us start off as donors and as volunteers and so forth. But the one thing we have to keep in mind is the opportunities that we're missing, the trade-offs that we're making when we choose to support one charity instead of another. So if we look at the Buffalo Field Campaign as an example, or we certainly could look at many other examples as well. Let's say that I have, or that you have, $1,000. Let's say I have $1,000, and I want to donate it to help animals. Now, I don't know the Buffalo Field Campaign's exact numbers, but I imagine that for a donation of that size, if I look at the organization's overall budget, the number of buffalo they're able to save each year with the work that they do, that $1,000 I donate is, at best, maybe going to save one buffalo from being killed. Now, that is certainly a great thing. $1,000 to protect one animal is, certainly, we could say money well spent. But we have to realize that if I donate my $1,000 there to protect one animal, it means not donating that $1,000 to another charity that would be able to help 1,000 animals, to spare 1,000 animals who are just as unique individuals, just as valuable individuals as that buffalo, from a lifetime of misery. And so we have to be aware that every one of us right now is probably missing opportunities to do bigger and better things for more animals. And so we should try to look for what opportunities are out there and where we might want to move our donation dollars or our volunteer time to be able to help an even greater number of animals. And you're totally right that if to do that, it requires changing our habits, and it may mean donating to causes that don't resonate with us as much on an emotional level, but that we're able to recognize that even though it doesn't resonate with us as much emotionally, it doesn't push our emotional buttons as much, that it still is an area that will do more good for animals.
And getting to that, you have your 9 steps to greatness where you can try to overcome these biases and habits or whatever, or emotional connections to certain ones. And do you want to tell us a little bit about how people can go about rethinking how they make their donations using these steps?
Absolutely. So just to kind of give the synopsis, most of us who donate to charity, as we've been talking about, we make those decisions for unemotional reasons. We tend to support causes that we're passionate about, that have relevance to us, that are local to us. But if we want to be great at doing good, if we want to move the world in as much of a positive direction as we can, we need to think a little more critically about those decisions, and we need to look at the results. Just as if we were investing in the stock market, we would try to invest in stocks that had the biggest return on our investment. When we donate to charity, we should also look to figure out which charities and which causes will give us the best return on our donation. In other words, how can we get the greatest amount of good out for the world with the limited amount of time and money that each of us has to spend? And so to be able to accomplish that, first, we need to go into our charity work with the mindset of, I want to win. I want to succeed as much as possible. I want to create the most amount of positive change for the world possible to reduce suffering and to help as many individuals as I can. Number two, we need to put in some time to do research. The average American buying a new car or a used car will spend about 20 hours of research before deciding which model, which make and model to settle on. When we're donating to charity, we are really making life or death decisions for a number of individuals. And so we should put in some research time there as well, some researching different charities and different options to try to figure out, again, where we can get the most value for our dollar, where our money will spend the furthest and help the greatest number of individuals. And third, and finally, we do, as you pointed out, need to be aware of the psychological biases that we all have. We'd like to think that we're very logical, rational creatures, we human beings. But the fact is that when it comes to charity or really anything else, we're so often being guided by unconscious processes. And the same is true with charity. So many of our decisions, our charity decisions, are made based on what pushes our emotional button and not necessarily on what's going to do the most good for the greatest number of animals. But the more we are aware of those biases and the more we pay attention to them, the more we're able to get around them and not let them derail us from creating the change we want to create. So we need to pay attention to those biases and try to work around them so that they are not steering us and not steering our charity decisions in a poor direction.
How do you see that affecting the development of small groups that want to work to help animals? I mean, because a lot of the most effective organizations are those that are larger because they have, you know, just by size alone, things seem to become more efficient, right? And so if you're a small group and you're trying to start an animal advocacy organization, how would this philosophy of going for the greatest good effect, how would you get started in if you wanted to start a group? I'm just trying to work through the mechanics of, you know, say I'm going to go out and start a new group. And in the face of this, it seems like the best thing to do would to give all my money instead of starting a group to going to give money to the most efficient group that's already there. But I wonder if I have an idea that I think that would be more efficient in the long run. How would I go about that?
Sure. So I have two answers. So one quick comment in terms of whether bigger or smaller charities are more efficient, it really depends. There's advantages that come with size, but there can also be disadvantages. It really depends on the organization. That Animal Charity Evaluators.org organization I mentioned, if we go there and we look at their top recommended charities, those aren't the biggest charities in the world. The largest, most name-recognizable animal protection charities are not there among the most effective and most recommended charities. It is kind of mid-sized to slightly smaller charities. So bigger is not always better. For a person who is starting their own animal advocacy organization or charity, the most important thing is to go into it with this attitude, the attitude that, okay, if I really believe that every animal matters, that every animal's life matters, then I should do the work that's going to help the greatest number of animals. So when deciding which cause to work on and which programs to work on, what I should do is I should look at all the options out there, from rescuing cats or dogs to providing sanctuary to animals to protecting wildlife and so forth. I should look at all the options out there and then do the programs and work on the causes that I truly believe will help the greatest number of individual animals. That's, I think, the main mistake that most of us make when either donating to charity or, in cases like this, starting organizations. We get involved with causes that we just happen to feel passionate about or that we feel we have a unique skill set to get involved with. But we don't necessarily pick those causes based on what will help the greatest number of animals. And so if I was giving advice to someone who is starting their own animal advocacy group or organization, it would be to work on the causes and the issues that will help the greatest number of animals. And again, if we look at the research and data, it becomes very clear that it's working on farm animal protection issues, working on encouraging the public to move towards a vegetarian or vegan eating, those just happen to be the causes where people like you and I can spare the greatest number of animals from misery, save the most lives, with the limited amount of time and money and energy that each one of us has.
Well, I'm curious, too, if maybe we've teased our listeners long enough, but what are some of the organizations that you have found, at least personally, that you've you know, that you're really excited about what they're doing in terms of the impact per dollar?
Sure. So in doing research for the book, one of the things I did is I looked up different areas of animal protection work, and I tried to figure out what does it actually cost to save the life of an animal. So I looked up my local SPCA and other cat and dog rescues and found that there the average was $500 or $600 for each animal spared. I looked up some of the country's largest sanctuaries, organizations that take in farmed animals or horses or wild animals and provide them with lifelong care in a sanctuary setting. And I found that there, many sanctuaries, especially the largest and most prominent, were spending thousands of dollars for each animal they spared. I also looked up some of the country's top wildlife protection organizations and organizations working to help elephants and whales and other wildlife, and found that there, many were spending upwards of $10,000 for each animal that they protected. But if we look to the research of that animal charity evaluators organization I've been mentioning, their research suggests, and certainly my research suggests as well, that many of the top farm animal advocacy charities are spending less than $1 for every animal they help. And so that means that if I have $5,000 to donate, literally it can mean the difference between protecting one animal or a few animals, protecting thousands and thousands of animals just based on which charities I support. And the top recommended charities from animal charity evaluators are Mercy for Animals, the Humane League, and Animal Equality, all of which happen to work on farm animal advocacy issues and vegetarian advocacy issues. Now, I should note as a word of disclaimer that I work for Mercy for Animals, and I'm on the board of Humane League, so I have a personal connection with both of those charities. But I would definitely encourage any of your listeners to check out the Animal Charity Evaluators website, so they can see the methodology and the thinking that goes into which charities they recommend and why.
We've been talking with Nick Cooney, who's Director of Education at Mercy for Animals and author of the new book, How to Be Great at Doing Good. If you want to visit Mercy for Animals, that's mercyforanimals.org. And Nick, can you tell us where our listeners can go to find out more about your book and perhaps buy it?
Absolutely. So to learn more about How to Be Great at Doing Good, the book website is www.nickcooney.com. But you could also just look for How to Be Great at Doing Good on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any other online bookseller or some retail stores as well.
Thanks, Nick, and thanks for being with us on ACT Radio today.
Thanks so much for having me and for all the great work you do.
As temperatures are starting to rise, remember that the inside of closed vehicles can quickly become dangerous for both pets and people. So remember, leave the pets at home with plenty of shade and water, or even better yet, in the house.
If you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso's website at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button.
Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.